most companies, they don't actually die because they have a bad product. They die because they make a promise they just cannot keep.
Exactly. It is rarely the product itself that takes them down.
Right. So today we are taking a deep dive into the intensely unglamorous mechanics of why businesses actually survive and, you know, why so many quietly implode before they ever even reach the public eye.
Yeah, it's the stuff nobody wants to talk about until it's on fire.
Completely. And you, the ultimate learner, are here because you want to know how the world actually works beneath the surface, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you're, I don't know, gearing up for a major strategy meeting or launching your own venture or just looking for that mental edge.
We are stripping away the corporate jargon today to really look at the raw machinery of success.
We so often get distracted by, like, the flashy product launches or the highly charismatic founder.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the actual survival of an organization, it always comes down to operational systems.
It's really dry stuff.
Right. The systems that most people find incredibly dry to talk about, right up until the moment those systems break. And when they break, well, it is a crisis.
And to understand how to prevent that exact crisis, we are drawing on a really fascinating resource today from Angel to Exit.
Yeah, they are a major incubator and accelerator.
Based out in the San Francisco Bay Area region, right?
That's the one. They sit right in the trenches watching countless companies try to get off the ground.
And their material, I mean, it pulls absolutely no punches about what separates the winners from the losers. Okay, let's unpack this. Because the source offers a foundational shift in perspective right out of the gate.
It really reorients how you think about operations.
Yeah. Usually when you hear the phrase supply chain, your brain immediately pictures like massive cargo ships, right? Or huge warehouses just stacked to the ceiling with cardboard boxes.
Which is the traditional physical view, sure.
Right. But Angel to Exit redefines it completely. They argue that a supply chain is fundamentally about fulfilling promises.
That is the key phrase right there. Fulfilling promises.
Whatever you promise a customer, in exchange for whatever they promise you, which is usually money, let's be honest, that requires a supply chain and a processing capability to actually make it happen.
And that framing, it changes the entire life cycle of a business.
How so?
Well, if you think of a business merely as a series of, you know, isolated transactions, you focus solely on the end product. You just look at the widget.
Right.
But viewing it as a continuous web of promises, that forces you to focus on your systemic capability to keep your word over time.
Which early stage founders are famously bad at?
Oh, they stumble blindly into this. They operate in what the source explicitly calls an ad hoc manner.
Just flying by the seat of their pants.
Basically, yeah. They assume they can just source whatever they need exactly whenever they happen to need it.
Right.
But failing to deliver on a promise you have made to a client just because you didn't plan your supply chain is the absolute fastest way to destroy a hard-earned reputation.
I mean, if you promise your clients that a new piece of software will launch by Tuesday, your developers, your server hosting, the open source code libraries you use, that all is your supply chain.
Exactly. It's not just boxes on ships.
If it is not live by Tuesday, the promise is broken, regardless of whether it's digital or physical. Which brings us to the operational reality of how companies mature in keeping these promises.
The maturity ladder.
Yes, the source lays out five distinct levels of supply chain maturity. And looking at it as a ladder really exposes how fragile new businesses are.
This is a bit of a reality check.
So level one is literally defined as having no fulfillment supply chain in place. Which, I mean, sounds like a paradox.
Right. How do you have a business with no supply chain?
But the source points out that this is your permanent status until you actually fulfill a promise to completion for the very first time.
Because you do not have a supply chain until you have actually supplied something.
It's all theoretical.
Exactly. It is purely theoretical until it is executed. Once you cross that threshold, you step into level two.
Which is having a fulfillment supply chain in place for immediate needs.
Right. But the text offers a really sobering reality check for founders hovering at this specific stage.
Yeah, I love this part.
It says, if you fulfilled the promise once, you should logically be able to do it again, unless you exhausted a critical resource along the way.
That unless is doing a lot of heavy lifting. That caveat is huge.
It's the trap of early success.
Think about a startup trying to get off the ground, right? You fulfill your first major client order, but to do it, you completely burn out your lead developer who just worked like 80-hour weeks.
Yep.
Or you used up the absolute last batch of some discontinued microchip you found on eBay. You kept the promise once, but the system is fundamentally unsustainable.
You survived the battle, but doomed the war.
Exactly.
So moving past that fragile state requires reaching level three.
And level three is where your fulfillment supply chain actually meets current pricing and volume requirements.
Right. You can deliver your product regularly. And critically, you can do it at a cost structure that makes mathematical sense.
But there is a fascinating, almost hilarious blind spot the source calls out regarding this specific tier.
Oh, the demand delusion.
Yeah. Some companies look at their perfectly balanced books and assume they have reached level three maturity, completely ignoring the fact that they have absolutely no orders coming in.
If demand is zero, well, your supply chain perfectly matches demand.
It's perfectly balanced.
That's a fatal delusion, though. True level three involves regular fulfillment.
Now, the text notes that even if a company is utilizing loss leaders like intentionally taking a financial hit on a product to capture market share, they still qualify as level three.
Provided they are intentionally and reliably meeting those volume requirements as part of a, you know, a broader strategy.
Right. But level three is still just surviving. It's stable, but it's surviving.
Because you don't have backups yet.
Exactly. Which is why level four introduces select redundancy for critical components.
This is a big step up.
I look at this like driving down a really desolate stretch of highway with a spare tire in the trunk. You are intentionally planning for a single point of failure.
You know the tire might blow, so you have a backup.
Yeah. If your primary supplier goes bankrupt tomorrow, you have a backup lined up for the single most critical part of your promise.
Select redundancy is absolutely the hallmark of a maturing operation. But the source pushes even further to level five.
The holy grail.
Right, which represents a fully redundant supply chain capable of meeting current and anticipated volumes.
Which means stripping away the last non-redundant supply of absolutely everything.
And they do not just mean physical materials here. They mean people, facilities, parts, labor, training protocols, everything.
Okay, I have to push back on the reality of that, though.
Go for it.
Building a duplicate universe just in case the first one breaks, seems like a really fast track to burning through all your venture capital. Isn't a fully redundant level five supply chain basically impossible for a lean startup?
It sounds like overkill.
You would need backups for your backups before you've even scaled.
Well, what's fascinating here is that the source actually agrees with that skepticism.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. They explicitly state that achieving level five across the board is incredibly hard and rarely achieved in reality.
So why even aim for it?
Because it serves as an ideal state. The value isn't necessarily in achieving it perfectly on day one.
Okay.
The value is that striving for it forces leadership to aggressively identify every single point of failure within their promise-making machinery.
Ah, okay. So the goal isn't necessarily to buy two of everything right now. The goal is to map the vulnerability.
Exactly. You map the gaps.
But mapping the supply chain only covers the inputs, right? Securing the materials, hiring the people, establishing the backups, that is just gathering the ingredients.
You still have to actually bake the cake.
Right. You still have to transform those raw inputs into the finished promise, which moves us naturally from supply chain to processing capacity.
The second major framework from the text.
Because getting the materials is useless if your internal capability to assemble, code, or manufacture them is fundamentally broken.
And just like the supply chain, processing capacity scales up its own five-level ladder.
Right. And the bottom rung, level one, basically mirrors the supply chain. Your fulfillment processing is non-existent or completely ad hoc.
The first time you manufacture your product, it is just chaotic.
You are relying on sheer heroics to get it out the door.
8 nights, lots of coffee.
Reaching level two means you can finally process at your current capacity reliably. The source notes that hitting level two means you have worked out the kinks.
You've ironed out the immediate process.
Yeah, you can execute the same fulfillment repeatedly with very few surprises. I think about this like a busy highway at rush hour. Level two means the cars are flowing smoothly at the speed limit.
Everything looks great.
The system works perfectly, right up until one single car taps its brakes.
And then chaos. A highway operating at 100% capacity is incredibly efficient until a minor disruption creates a massive cascading traffic jam.
Yeah.
And this perfectly illustrates why the text insists that simply processing at your current capacity is an operational trap. It feels like success, but it is deeply, deeply fragile.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because that makes the leap to level three so critical and honestly so difficult.
It requires a mindset shift.
Level three of processing capacity requires what the source calls reasonable overage capacity.
Right.
You need the internal machinery to handle more volume than you are currently selling. But let's look at the financial reality of that.
It's expensive.
Yeah. If I am running a cash-strapped operation, why on earth would I pay for extra capacity I am not using yet? Doesn't that just burn cash?
It seems counterintuitive.
Building an extra lane on that highway that usually sits completely empty seems like a terrible allocation of limited capital.
It definitely looks like a waste of capital if you only evaluate today's balance sheet.
Right.
But the source provides the underlying mechanism for why this is mandatory. Without overage capacity and the economies of scale that come with it, a company simply cannot grow.
Because they hit a ceiling.
Imagine you are maxed out just handling your current daily orders, and tomorrow you land a transformative, massive client.
The dream scenario.
Right, but if you lack the overage capacity to absorb that spike, you fail to deliver. The promise breaks on the biggest stage possible.
Oh, wow. You essentially choke on your own success.
Precisely. The text issues a stark warning here. If an organization lacks the potential for sustainability and growth, which explicitly requires that buffer of overage, they will inevitably face a crisis.
Margins shrink.
Margins will shrink. Competitors with overage will absorb the overflow demand, and the company will stagnate.
So the ultimate objective, found at levels 4 and 5, is flexible scale-up.
Yes. Mature companies can meet a manageable range of anticipated demand at an acceptable cost.
And the pinnacle of this ladder isn't just about having massive factories or, like, thousands of developers sitting around. The text emphasizes that at level 5, you can rapidly scale up any down.
That down part is critical.
Yeah, to meet changing needs caused by external disruptions, all while maintaining rigorous cost controls. It is about elasticity, not just sheer size.
Because elasticity protects the bottom line. When demand suddenly drops, a rigid company bleeds cash because they cannot scale down their operational costs.
They're stuck paying for the empty factory.
Exactly. An elastic company shrinks its processing footprint temporarily and survives the winter.
Okay, so let's bring this into the room with the investors.
The fun part.
Suppose you have survived the gauntlet. You have an elastic processing capacity and a highly redundant supply chain. You walk into Angel to Exit, or, you know, any major accelerator, and claim you are operating at level 5 maturity.
They're not going to just hand over a check based on a confident pitch deck.
Right. The diligence process is where the dreamers are separated from the serious operators. The source outlines a very gritty, demanding set of documentation required to empirically prove your maturity level.
They want to see the actual math.
The receipts.
Yeah.
The list in the source is intense. They demand historical demands, projected future demands, and the analytical working papers used to generate those exact projections.
Not just a summary.
No. And what does an analytical working paper actually look like in this context? Because it sounds like a lot more than just a spreadsheet.
Oh, it is. An analytical working paper is the tracked history of your assumptions.
Okay.
It shows your baseline metrics, expected material costs, conversion rates, labor hours, and it mathematically demonstrates how those numbers behave if demand spikes by 50%.
Or if a supplier raises prices unexpectedly.
Exactly. It is showing your work. It's proving that your projections are rooted in observed reality rather than just, you know, optimistic guesswork.
Furthermore, they demand rigorous quality control and assurance measurements. But the most striking part of their diligence requirements, to me, is their focus on the negative.
The dark side of operations.
Yes. They do not just want to highlight real. Investors specifically demand to see your late and inadequate fulfillment records.
They want to see where it broke.
They want documents detailing your capacity saturation issues and your waste and shrinkage. They intentionally hunt for the dark side. They want to know, how did the company handle a furious client?
Was the situation resolved, or did the relationship just end?
Right.
That focus on failure is incredibly deliberate. An incubator knows with absolute certainty that things will go wrong in a growing business.
It's guaranteed.
So if a founder presents documentation painting a picture of a flawless history, the investor assumes the founder has either not pushed the company hard enough to break anything yet, Or
they're actively hiding the bodies.
Exactly.
This is such a powerful paradigm shift for you listening right now. Whether you are running a massive corporate division or just managing a localized team project.
It applies everywhere.
We are all conditioned to track our wins, right? We build these beautiful dashboards for revenue and user growth.
Always up and to the right.
But keeping a meticulous, unvarnished record of your waste and shrinkage, or your late fulfillments, is the only true barometer of your own operational maturity.
Because investors do not fund flawless execution, they fund documented recovery.
If you do not have records of your systemic failures, you simply cannot prove that you have built the mechanisms to prevent them from happening again.
You are asking an investor to trust your systems, not your look. The documentation proves you actually learned from the scars.
Given how rigorous this burden of proof is, the detailed maturity levels, the demand for overage capacity, the forensic documentation of failures, how do early stage companies even get off the starting block?
It sounds completely paralyzing.
It really does.
Which is why the Angel to Exit material issues a very clear warning about the fatal flaw most early stage operations commit.
Jumping down a path destined for failure without doing the simple back-of-the-envelope math first.
That's the one.
The text highlights that the biggest mistake ending companies, even well-financed ones, is skipping the basic arithmetic. I compare this to trying to build a custom home by running into an empty field with a hammer, without ever checking if wood and nails even exist in your zip code.
That is a perfect analogy. The initial excitement of the idea frequently blinds leadership to the unglamorous mechanics of execution.
So how do you fix it?
To counteract this, the text outlines a methodology that basically acts as the scientific method for early stage business.
Okay.
It requires three distinct phases. The first is fact gathering. Before you build anything, you must understand the true time frames, the hard costs, and the actual availability of your supply and fulfillment capacity.
Like, who currently possesses the expertise you need? Who has empirically performed these tasks before?
Right. You gather the raw facts.
But facts in a vacuum don't tell you if the business will actually survive contact with the market.
No, they don't.
You have to actively stress test those facts against reality.
Wait.
Is that the purpose of the modeling phase?
Yes, and this is where most founders fundamentally misunderstand the assignment.
How so?
Well, during the modeling phase, you take those gathered facts and simulate the business. You project the scaling, the inevitable time delays, and the required levels of effort.
And then you move to the analysis phase, comparing the results of your model to your available resources.
Right, but when founders build these models, the natural temptation is to build a spreadsheet that proves the idea will generate $1 billion.
Oh, of course. You want the model to validate your brilliance.
But this raises an important question. What is the actual point of the model? The text explicitly warns against that validation mindset.
The goal isn't to prove you'll succeed.
No. The source dictates that the objective of early stage modeling is to quickly identify failure modes. Your objective is to find out exactly how and when the idea breaks.
Okay, walk us through what identifying a failure mode actually looks like in practice.
Sure. Suppose your fact gathering reveals that a critical component takes 4 weeks to arrive from overseas.
Okay, pretty standard.
You plug that into your model. The analysis shows that if a client requests a rush order in 2 weeks, your entire production line halts. That is a failure mode. Discovering it forces you to change the parameters. You either source a local, more expensive supplier for rush orders, or you pre-purchase inventory.
And then you feed those new facts back into the model.
And you analyze it again. You iterate continuously until you find a path that actually survives the stress test.
So you are actively trying to bankrupt your own business model on paper, so you do not bankrupt it in real life with real venture capital.
Exactly. You fail fast and you fail cheap on the back of an envelope.
Once the model survives the mathematical stress test, you have a baseline.
You do.
But those models exist in a theoretical vacuum until you introduce the final, most complex variable.
Industry-specific context.
Yes. The deep dive shifts significantly here because the text provides specific examples illustrating how the industry you choose fundamentally alters every mechanism we have discussed so far.
So what does this all mean when we look at different industries?
Well, the source pulls some great extremes. For instance, if you are building a software as a service or SaaS company, your supply chain reality is relatively forgiving.
Because it's digital.
Right. You have dozens of options for cloud hosting, redundant data centers are easily accessible, and your fulfillment processes can be fully automated in milliseconds.
The cascading effects of a supply chain failure in SaaS are often mitigated by the sheer volume of alternative suppliers. The barrier to achieving redundancy is just significantly lower.
But the source contrasts that immediately with the submarine business.
A slightly different supply chain.
Just a bit. If you are manufacturing submarines, your supplier pool for, say, specialized pressure valves is microscopically small. Fulfilling a single order takes months or years.
Right.
The cascading effects of one supplier going bankrupt are catastrophic because you cannot simply spin up a new vendor the way you spin up an AWS instance.
The complexity of your promise dictates the fragility of your supply chain.
Absolutely. The source also mentions manufacturing custom shoes in high volume.
Oh, that's a good one.
A founder in that space will quickly discover that off-the-shelf machinery will not suffice. They will likely have to design and build their own manufacturing equipment, creating a nested supply chain problem.
You are no longer just making shoes, you are making the machines that make the shoes.
It fundamentally changes the risk profile. You can build a flawless spreadsheet model, but if your industry requires custom-built machinery, your capital requirements just skyrocketed.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the source poses several fundamental questions that remind us fulfillment is only one piece of the puzzle.
Right. There's a whole business attached to this.
Exactly. How are you actually going to sell the product once it is made? How will you assure identical quality when you eventually have to utilize multiple suppliers providing the exact same component?
Just to meet volume.
Right. Are your internal components genuinely replaceable?
And the most brutal reality check of all. After paying for all this select redundancy, investing in overage processing capacity, and documenting your failure modes, will the margins leave enough money to actually operate the management of the company?
A mature supply chain is totally useless if the cost of maintaining it starves the rest of the organization.
It's a constant, grueling balancing act between operational capability and financial reality.
Every step up that ladder demands exponentially more effort to attain and sustain.
Which brings us to the ultimate conclusion derived from the angel to exit material. The unglamorous mechanics of keeping your promises, maturing your supply chain and your processing capacity, is the absolute foundation of long-term survival.
It's the bedrock.
The golden rule they leave us with in the text is simple but incredibly demanding. Plan your supply chain issues and map them into fulfillment requirements at least one step ahead of your current efforts.
Always be building the capacity for tomorrow's promises today.
For those of you listening who are in the trenches right now, pressure testing your own models, the source offers a highly actionable resource.
Yeah, they don't just leave you hanging.
Angel to Exit hosts free monthly advisory calls. They typically run at 0900 Pacific time on the first and third Thursday of most months.
Which is an incredible opportunity to bring your specific operational bottlenecks to a group that has likely seen those exact failure modes before.
It is a phenomenal environment for the rigorous fact gathering and modeling we just explored.
But, you know, I want to leave you with a final thought to consider long after this deep dive ends.
I'll hear it.
We have spent this time analyzing businesses as webs of promises, right? Fulfilled by complex supply chains. Well, apply that exact same framework to your own professional and personal life.
Oh, wow.
Every commitment you make to a client, a colleague, or your family is a promise. Identify the single most critical promise you make on a daily basis. When the unexpected inevitably happens, do you actually have a redundant supply chain in place to ensure you never break it?
That is a question that requires some very serious operational honesty. Thank you for diving into the machinery with us today. We will catch you on the next one.